The Taconican Green Board of School Directors had their first in-depth look at the district's proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year on Tuesday, December 6th. The budget is still a work in progress, and some of the information that will drive tax rates and the final bottom line are not yet available. The Taconican Green Board will be meeting again on December 20th for its next review of the spending plan, and the public will have an opportunity to weigh in. The budget that voters will be asked to endorse during March town meeting will be finalized in January. The Taconican Green Regional School District, which includes the towns of Danby, Dorset, Landgrove, Londonderry, Manchester, Mount Tabor, Peru, Sunderland, and Weston, and operates five elementary and middle schools, which include the Currier Memorial School in Danby, the Floodbrook School in Londonderry, the Manchester Elementary Middle School, Sunderland Elementary Middle School, and the Dorset School, is looking at a budget proposal that's starting off would have a 6% increase over the current budget, representing a bottom-line increase from about $34.5 million to about $36.6 million. Susan Wilborn, the business manager for the Bennington-Rutland Supervisor Union, of which the Taconican Green School District is part of, gave us an overview.
So, yeah, we do have some added positions in the budget. I'd say that's the biggest driver. We have some additional positions for social-emotional support and academic intervention, and we have some additional positions for classroom instructional support. We're not quite sure, I think, what we're calling this yet, but to have a team approach to classrooms, to have more support, more consistent support for the kids when people are absent, when they're out, so that kids are seeing the same people and we're not having subs coming in and out of the building as much. So that would be one of the main drivers. Obviously, we have health insurance going up average of 12.9%. So that's a big cost increase. And secondary tuition rate increases always impacts the budget as well. January. At our January meeting, the board will vote the final budget. And at that point, we'll have a good handle of a tax rate estimate and can make some budget decisions on whether or not to draw from reserves, what the tax rate might look like. Right now, the state is estimating a pretty significant 16.3% increase in the base rate, which will drive tax rates down. But on the other side of that, we have common level appraisals in individual towns, which will drive tax rates up if they go down, meaning that if the cost of homes, if the value of homes is going up and the assessed value of homes is not being done, reassessment basically, then we're going to see that common level appraisal go down, which will drive tax rates up. So having the base rate from the state be increased is very helpful. We don't know if that base rate will stick or not. The legislators have to vote on that. They'll do that in the spring. So,
now, if I recall correctly, you're also coming into this budget cycle with a surplus left over from last year of about $250,000.
Right now, we're anticipating a surplus of about half a million this year. That's, you know, a moving target. We still have some unfilled positions. We don't know if we're going to be able to fill those. And some positions we put anticipated costs in for and hoping that we're going to fill them. And some positions we've taken the anticipated costs out saying, okay, well, we don't expect we're going to fill these positions this year. But that could change. So what we anticipate right now, it may end up being different in June. What we're going to do with this money, though, what the board is going to have to make a decision on whether or not they'd like to ask the voters to transfer any surplus into tax stabilization, as they've done in the past, whether or not we use some of this money towards next year's budget to help offset education spending and lower the tax rate. So those are decisions the board will make at their January meeting.
The budget is an effort to match up costs with the changing needs of the education system, which reflect to a degree the impact of the COVID pandemic. School Superintendent Randy Lowe spoke to this point during the Taconican Green board meeting.
So I think probably there's a few big moves sort of in this budget as I see it. The first one relates to the merger. So when there were 7 different districts, you all had your own budgets. You all budgeted differently. Mm-hmm. And the merge happened, and one of the steps that wasn't ever taken was to be looking at like intervention services academic intervention services and social emotional services. And those are those first two bullets under budget to budget staffing. And that's been something that has been on my mind, because I knew that when I looked at the budget that we did not from the local budget staff in an equitable manner across our schools. And that was due to the different priorities and the ways that individual districts in the past have budgeted. So Sue and I spent a long time this budget development season looking at what intervention services were budgeted from what place, and work to ensure that we had equitable funding at the local level, so that across, we did all BRSU schools. We didn't just do Taconic and Green. We included Medawee as well, because for me, while you're different districts, I think about all of our kids as all of our kids, because that's how I see it. So that meant that we made some changes for positions that had been funded from the title grant, the CFP grant. So we made some changes from things that were grant funded to being locally funded. And so you know, the intent of Title I funds is meant to provide additional funding to support communities that have a higher poverty level. So the idea, the whole premise of title funding is that there's you're funding at an equitable basis across all of your schools, and then these funds go to provide additional resources for those places where we know need it. It's not how we've operated since TNG came. So this budget reflects that. So the changes in the academic intervention, the instructional intervention line, are in order to provide that equitable programming. So now, as we look ahead to next year, the budget you're approving levels the playing field locally, and we will see additional intervention in our Title I eligible schools. In your case, it's Manchester and Courier. And we did the same thing with social emotional programming. So we're talking about the semantics as far as I'm concerned about language, but guidance counselors, social emotional intervention, we did the same thing. We want to make sure that the places that we have equitable services across our schools. And so, you know, when we're trying to do that, we have choices to make. We either level the playing field this way, or we level the playing field this way. And the increases are in order to provide what I consider to be needed at this time. You've heard me talk for a long time now about the challenges we're facing educationally. We are not unique. We are right with everybody else. And I feel like what we've done in this budget to level that is the right thing for our system right now. Over time, maybe that will change. But we continue to have children who are struggling. And we have a responsibility to provide the services in our schools to meet those needs right now. There's a lot of post-pandemic impact we're still seeing. I am saying to you that what's in here, I believe we continue to need right now.
The Bennington-Rutland Supervisory Union's budget will be reviewed at their next board meeting on December 19th, and the Taconic and Green Board will be meeting again the following night on December 20th. Both meetings will start at 6:30 p.m. and are watchable via Zoom. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Londonderry, like virtually every other community in Vermont, is struggling to meet a demand for housing. The stock of inventory is low, and often people who have been recruited or hired for jobs in the local area aren't able in the end to take them, because the cost of the housing that is on the market is too expensive. Or they are forced into long commutes that eat up time and dollars for gasoline. Londonderry is currently conducting a housing survey, and the results are expected early next year. But in the meantime, one new home for a family of average means is under construction. The Mountain Towns Housing Project, a volunteer-driven organization, is coordinating the building of the home. It raised $100,000 to get the project started. According to a recent press release, The Bob Perry Lane project started in early 2021 when a longtime local family concerned with the lack of workforce housing decided to donate 1.8 acres in Londonderry for an affordable housing project. The donor's hope was to build a house on the property to make one family's dream of home ownership a reality. Later in 2021, a group of interested Mountain Town residents organized the Mountain Town's Housing Project Steering Committee with the goal of bringing this dream to a reality. The steering committee consists of volunteers from a variety of towns, including Weston, Londonderry, South Londonderry, Andover, Wyndham, and Ludlow. The group has also been working with the Wyndham and Windsor Housing Trust, an affordable housing nonprofit developer serving Wyndham and Windsor counties. At the Second Congregational Church in Londonderry, we met up with Paul Alcorn, the chair of the Mountain Towns Housing Project, and Cynthia Gubb, another member of the committee, to hear more about what's been going on.
We started just as a very informal group that gathered around this table, I think, to talk about this offer of a gift of land that a family here in Londonderry, a couple here in Londonderry, had offered for, as an affordable housing site, and said, you know, is this possible? Can we do it? Can a volunteer community group, other than kind of a developer or contractor, pool together the resources and the skills to build an affordable house in the community? And those conversations started about a year ago and kind of quickly got to the point where we said, yes, we're going to kind of take the plunge and move ahead and do this. So.
And the family were inspired. They belong to this church, the Second Congregational Church, where this interview was taking place. And they were in the congregation one day when they had a guest speaker from Habitat for Humanity. And they went home that night and they said, well, that's a really inspiring model. Is that something that we could do? So this is a born and bred Vermont family. Their resources are in land, not in money. And they came to Lori and asked, you know, is it possible we could donate this land to the church and have an affordable house built on it for a family of modest means? So that's how it all got started.
Yep, they were inspired, I think, largely by Habitat's model as a hand out rather than a hand up, you know, or is that?
A hand up instead of a hand out.
Yeah. You know, but to say, you know, that the community can really rally around and support others in the community, you know, so that, that people are able to kind of take that next step and have a home and be a viable member, you know, of the communities in which we live. And, you know, for me, what's inspiring is not just the generosity, but that's a model of community that has largely been lost in our current culture, that that communities can step up and rally together and do a project like this and say, you know, we all have some part and some responsibility to making our communities, you know, stronger and more inclusive and, you know, a place for all.
And especially in our resort communities, you know, we all live in mountainous areas that have ski resorts, and the competition for real estate is intense. Right. So anything that's even halfway modest can be snapped up quickly. So a young family trying to get into the housing market really doesn't have a chance. So the selection process will be based on a number of criteria. We haven't yet established what those will be, but we'll be working with the Habitat for Humanity chapter in Bennington County, and working with Wyndham and Windsor Housing Trust to come up with that criteria. And it will encompass a family that will be making between 47 and 109,000, which is 80 to 120% of the area median income in Wyndham County.
So. It's similar to the Habitat model. Obviously, there are parts of the construction of a home that takes the skilled trades, right? So, you know, those folks will obviously be involved. A number of them have already offered to donate services or to do so at a reduced cost. But our goal all along has been to say, let's also have the community involved. So not only to help keep down the actual cost of the construction of the house, but that if the community gathers around to work on the house, then there's kind of that sense of, we're a part of this, we're in this together. And this is the, again, building on the model of the couple that donated the house. You know, the community can come together and step up and, you know, build a house like this. So once the shell is in place, which we hope will be the case when mud season is over, then we'll begin using volunteers to kind of do the work that volunteers can do, you know, whether that's paint clapboard or put up insulation or help hang sheetrock or, you know, all of those tasks that with, you know, leadership, you know, any of us can do.
It would be ideal to have a family in by late fall, early winter of 2023.
So my when, you know, my original goal was to have somebody in the house by this Christmas. You know, it was like, we are going to do this, and obviously that has not happened, but I think it's very realistic that a year from now a family can be moving in to celebrate the holidays in the new home.
Is this the sort of project you think that is a sort of could be duplicated or
scalable,
repeated
that is
in
the
more
hope.
And more cases?
Yes, that's definitely the hope, that once we are successfully completed this project, we can continue and look at other opportunities within our community. It doesn't have to be Londonderry. It could be Weston. It could be Andover. It could be, you know,
Peru,
South Londonderry, right? Peru.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we're calling ourselves the Mountain Towns Housing Project. You know, if someone wants to donate a piece of property to our organization, then we can repeat the process and build a second home. So that's our goal, not to just stop at one, to keep going.
It may be only one home, but maybe this approach can yield more affordable homes, one at a time, for local families who would otherwise be priced out of the housing market and unable to raise families often in the same town where they grew up in. Vermont's housing crisis has been the subject of a lot of discussion in recent years, along with an influx of federal ARPA money, and the need is great. But the Mountain Towns Housing Project is another example of neighbors helping neighbors. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. About a dozen high-ranking state officials, agency and department heads, converged on the Manchester Community Library on Monday, December 5th, to share information with local officials and residents on how and for what purposes they can access about $1 billion allocated to Vermont from combined sources of federal revenue to build or rebuild infrastructure like housing, wastewater systems, broadband improvements, along with other projects that could benefit local libraries, farms and agriculture, or renewable energy, to name a few. The well-attended meeting, the second one in several the government officials are planning to make across the state, was a chance to hear directly from the officials who will ultimately sign off on those proposed projects, and for questions to be asked and answered. Lindsay Curley, the Secretary of the Education of Commerce and Community Development, got the meeting started.
I'm here with a lot of folks from the team from Governor Scott's administration. And as hopefully you all know, we're here to talk with you all about the ARPA funds that have come our way, and we're trying to make sure that we can get them all into this region. But really, you know, we have a real desire to understand what it is that you feel are maybe barriers that you have to trying to access this federal money. What are gaps that you're looking to have filled that maybe we haven't considered, additional resources that maybe you're looking for, but things that we aren't thinking of. We can go through that as we start to, you know, go around the room. But our goal here is not to talk at you. We are going to give you a little bit, like I said, a little understanding of the programs, but really want to make this an interactive conversation in hopes of really understanding what your needs are, and again, making sure that we can get this money into the region. So.
After each of the government officials had a chance to introduce themselves and describe what types of projects might be eligible for the one-time opportunity presented by the influx of federal funding, which prior to the COVID pandemic and the recovery revenues it has brought, would have seemed difficult to imagine, the floor was open to questions.
So I want you guys to help us find a creative way to invest now, maybe with ARPA or infrastructure funds, so that we can make money in the future. We welcome 13 million people to our state every year. We should be the leader in, let's say, green tourism. One of the issues I see us facing now is we talk a lot about EV. We talk about cars on the road. I still need those cars on the road. So we need to find a way to welcome all of those into our state in a very healthy and creative manner. So when your head, when you go to sleep, your car should go to sleep, etc. I know we've got Representative James here, who's a leader in the EV community with the legislature as well. But if we can find a way to create a program like we've done for the residential housing market, where you have put, a charging station for every 20 units over the last year, if we can create a program that puts charging stations in every lodging property so that no part of Vermont is inaccessible, so that people can come here and celebrate our state, spend good money, and help us fill the coffers when ARPA funds don't exist, I believe we will be better for it, and we will be the leader in an industry that really needs all the help it can get.
Apply as grants for hazard mitigation, and as it, would it apply both on public property and private property?
It depends.
I was hoping for short answers.
But since you raised cost shares, thank you. I want to talk about the cost shares related to the flood mitigation money, because I need to make this point. There has never been and will never be a better moment for communities to address their flooding risk, because ordinarily the federal money comes with a 25% non-federal share, which is heavy lift for small communities. Under the current HMGP funding, it's 90% federal share. And under the Flood Resilient Community Fund, it's up to 100%. Free money, essentially, for communities that want to undertake flood mitigation projects right now.
Is one of the things we've had in our Commons Economic Development Strategy since, I think, 2012? Was that when we first came? 2014. Trying to do a wastewater capacity assessment, not only for our region, the whole of the town, because it would really help us make the case. If we could say to the towns, like in the absence of community scale wastewater and water systems, you will get zero affordable housing at scale. You will get zero economic development or even kind of business revitalization benefit, because you just do not have the capacity on site in these villages to really do anything. You're kind of frozen in time. So if we actually had that data, that would be awesome. Our problem is, like, the Economic Development Administration and other entities won't fund that. And it's more than what we can do in-house. We could use existing data to really just pull that information together and tell the story in enough detail that it could really help us help the public understand what the limitations are. So that could be something I think could be done relatively quickly on a town-by-town and ultimately regional basis. And then that would give us the data to go out and tell the story for people who don't know what I mean when I say affordable housing at scale.
Doug Farnham is the Deputy Secretary of the Agency of Administration, where he helps provide administrative and support services to all Vermont state government agencies and departments.
So one reason we're out here connecting with all of you is we want more diversity in who's applying to our programs. The biggest problem we have today is that we need more applications. And at this point, basically, in a lot of the programs, if you apply and you qualify, you know, you're gonna have a good, really good chance of getting applied. We're not having to make a lot of decisions. We want to have to look at it and make decisions about who gets the funding. But we still want to see you change your capacity, change your position, so that you can take advantage of the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act. Like, we're seeing over the next 5 to 10 years an unprecedented amount of federal money, like New Deal levels of federal money.
And while there's still plenty of time for local communities to settle on what they would like to use the money for, the clock is ticking. States and municipalities have until December 31st, 2024, to designate where they will be investing the one-time money, and until December 31st, 2026, to actually spend it. We had a chance after the meeting to talk with some of the officials who took part in the meeting.
We worked really hard with the legislature to make sure that the investments that are made are transformative. And I think that we've done a good job ensuring that the money is going to the places where we need it most. We need housing, we need broadband, we need childcare, and we need economic development. So I think that we have an array of opportunity to put that money in those places where we need it right now. Obviously, for those projects that are shovel-ready, the money can go there, and that's great. Unfortunately, there are areas of the state that don't have projects that are shovel-ready, and what we're doing is we're trying to travel around and help those regions make sure that they have access to the money so that they can also create those transformational projects. To make sure that their regions are set up now and into the future, to make sure that they can really come out of this pandemic stronger than ever. So we're feeling good about it, but we have a lot of work to do.
But I'm heartened by, one, the number of community members that turned out and, fairly short notice around the holiday period. So there's obviously a significant amount of interest in our region trying to move projects forward, access resources that may in fact be one-time and once-in-a-lifetime resources, and I'm heartened by the administration's willingness to come out and discuss these projects, both in broad strokes with regard to the availability of programming, but also to kind of get into the nitty-gritty. I think the message we heard loud and clear from the administration representatives today was, tell us what your project is, we'll try to help you slot it into the best appropriate funding sources. So I think that is very good news. Again, as I noted during the session, the regional planning commissions are at the intersection of, you know, all of these different programs. We interact with every administration and agency that's out there on a regular basis, so we can certainly be a resource at the local level as well.
Sure. So there's actually a late kind of developing program through ACCD that I think the Dorset, with some water system improvements that we actually have out on the street, and we'll be bidding soon, might be eligible for, which is great. And then I think that there's some other nexuses, you know, here that might make sense for some, flooding improvements in Dorset, and then, you know, possibly some municipal energy building projects potentially in the future. So a lot of good info.
The meeting in Manchester was one part of a multi-pronged visit from state officials who fanned out across Bennington County to make stops in Arlington, Woodford, and Reedsboro. On Monday afternoon, Housing and Community Development Deputy Commissioner Alex Farrell visited the Bennington High School redevelopment on Main Street in Bennington, and Education Secretary Daniel French visited the Meadowee Community School in West Paulette, as well as schools in Wells and Pulteney. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.